Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 85. Modeling life with the world's fastest computer system, part 3.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the DNA extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
So potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun's the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. Today's guest did his BA in physics at Princeton University. He then went on and did his PhD also in physics at MIT and then stayed at MIT for his postdoctoral work. Currently, he's a professor in the departments of chemistry, structural biology, and computer science. He's the director of the program in biophysics and director of Folding at Home Distributed Computing at Stanford University. Our guest, Dr. Vijay Pandey, is at the forefront of both distributed computing and molecular simulation experiments, an extremely valuable combination when trying to model the movement of millions of atoms at a time. Predicting the fundamental processes of life to better understand diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or even cancer is not easy. Dr. Pandey's work is not only at the frontier, but in my humble opinion, is the frontier. He's been a guest on Futures in Biotech just about every 2 years on episode 27 in December 2007. And more recently, in 2009, on episode 41 in April 2009, his distributed computer system back in 2007 was running at 1.3 petaflops. And in April 2009 at 8.3, I think it was, 8.3 or 8.4 petaflops. So we'll find out more about the progress of that new frontier and his work. Welcome to the show.
Hi, great to see you again.
So it's one of the things that I think will be fun is, you know, we've been doing Futures in Biotech now, we're in our sixth year, is sometimes going back and looking at the work in a progressive way. And, you know, I've always been a fan of your work. So doing it, I appreciate you coming on to do this this show, you know, in this. And I think 2 years is just about the amount of time where there's amount of new data and a lot of innovation that has happened. So perhaps to start, you know, we should introduce, get to know you a little bit better, find about how your work has developed, what's your fundamental framework for setting up your science, and then we can go on to some of the hardware and technological aspects of distributed computing, and then hopefully go on to some of the scientific quests that you're trying to address. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about, you know, your training and, you know, bridging that gap into creating a research program.
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, in some ways my training started even in high school, you know, where I was really excited about science. And also, actually in high school, friends of mine were involved in writing computer games and actually had a computer game company that they eventually sold to Sony. So I had already, even at that time, a relatively strong programming background, but also really loved physical science and biology. But when I went to college, you know, I really wanted to study physics, but it was clear at that point that there was this interesting sort of confluence between physics and biology happening at that time. And biophysics seemed like a particularly exciting area. to try to bring the quantitative nature of physical approaches and physical science and the mathematics that's a part of that to biological questions. Especially, you know, just all the fascinating things in biology seem to be possible to be studied in a sort of more systematic way that a physicist might. And so that really shaped my thought in grad school and afterwards. And a lot of the work that we do now, it really, I think, reflects that approach, that we use methods that really try to go at the molecular physical nature of things, but answer questions that have hopefully fairly significant ramifications in biology and medicine.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about folding at home, and maybe my big question is the sense of it, the timing, right? We're going from an era of pre-genetics, pre-molecular biology to an era of molecular biology in the 90s. And then computational power is at a point where, you know, modeling of atoms is clearly, is it, you know, not in the 90s or even the 2000s, at a point where you can, you know, extend the time frame of a molecular dynamics experiment to be at par with the timing of a biological reaction, right?
Yeah.
Maybe you could give us a sense of the evolution of computational modeling and how folding at home sort of came in and started to say, oh, well, hey, now we can really do stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I started, when I was a postdoc, actually, I started doing atomistic simulations of very, very small protein systems. And those simulations were on the picosecond to nanosecond timescale. So to translate that, a nanosecond is 1/1,000,000th of a second, or a picosecond is 1 trillionth of a second. You know, I mean, these are really, really short timescales, and not just short timescales for human beings. They are really also short timescales just for what happens in a biological context. To get much more interesting biologically, you really want to get to milliseconds to seconds. That's even still short on a human context, but actually a lot can happen on a molecular context. But, you know, when we started folding at home in 2000, really fast machine using a simplified model could still only do about a nanosecond a day in terms of a simulation. And that means that if you want to get to a second, you know, that would take 1 billion days, you know, also known as, you know, 3 million years. So, you know, that's something where it's, yeah, it's not just about, and this is a joke I think I've used it before, but this is true, is that, you know, I was telling my mom about this, and, you know, I said about how I have this grand plan to maybe use hundreds of thousands of computers to try to break this impasse. And she told me, you know, I should just be more patient.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, but then, you know, actually, I talked to my dad about this more recently, and he somewhat clarified her comment saying that, you know, maybe my mom meant not just patient in terms of waiting 3 million years, but patient in terms of waiting for Moore's Law. That, you know, if you wait long enough, computers will become faster. But they're not going to become, A, they're not going to become that much faster. But B, I think part of it is that the types of things that we did with folding at home 10 years ago now can be done on massive clusters. But that means that we got to do it, you know, 10 years ago. We got to be pioneers in that area. And so that way, I often talk about folding at home being almost like a time machine of sorts, that we get to play with computers that would exist 10 years in the future. And the exciting thing is that then the methods that we're doing aren't just things that only we can use. Eventually, I think these methods will become really deeply rooted in the community more broadly. And I think that's what we've seen over the last decade.
Well, that seems to illustrate two things, right? The magnitude of the challenge of modeling life at the atomic level in terms of resources required, and sort of the timing of when you entered into this era, right? You're sort of a man before your time. I guess that's what keeps you at the frontier, is that you're asking questions that I guess nobody could ask, and starting to produce those answers. So,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, in particular, I think where we now are now in the story is that with folding at home 10 years ago, we could get to microseconds, which is 1/1,000,000th of a second. That's better. But now, you know, we've published results for studying phenomena on the millisecond timescale. And I think in the next 5 years, we should be able to get to seconds. We're already doing stuff on 10 milliseconds. And it's getting to the point now where we're getting very close to being able to sample everything that we wanted to do in terms of timescales. The methodology is really coming you know, we'll always want to push harder and harder and farther. But it's getting to the point where the methodology really has now opened many doors for us to do interesting things. And I think where I'm trying to think strategically for our program for Folding at Home is, what can we do to take those resources and do the best that we can with it, to do the sort of biggest bang for the buck? And so that's something we can talk about in terms of a little bit later about those directions. But it's an exciting time for me because I think we've sort of set out to have this pretty ambitious goal of getting to these long timescales, but yet with still atomic detail to study biology atom by atom. And now that we're getting, you know, pretty close to that goal, it's fun to think about what are the first things that we want to do with it.
Well, when you're talking about timescale, you're modeling how many atoms are in a protein?
It depends on the protein. Like, you know, for proteins involved in Alzheimer's, like the A-beta peptide, it has 42 amino acids. On an average, you know, amino acid might have 10 heavy atoms or so. So we're talking about, you know, somewhere between 500 and 1,000 atoms for one protein, one A-beta protein involved in Alzheimer's.
And when you model it, how many do you assemble?
Yeah, so we might want to have more than one. In the past, we've done up to 4. We're hoping to do more like 12 or 24. But then also, there's lots of atoms for the water. Water is, you know, really important, and wish we could not have to deal with it, but it is critically important. And so then, you know, the total number of atoms becomes somewhere between 10,000 and 100,000 in that range.
And that will get, with those kind of criteria, you can get to a millisecond.
Yeah, we have actually a published work for an AD residue protein, sort of single protein at the millisecond time scale already. And so that's something that is starting to become routine, to get to millisecond routine, not in the sense that we can do it every day, but that with a lot of effort, we've done it in multiple cases. I think that especially opens the door because experiments can reach the millisecond time scale very easily, but it's still a big challenge for them. But they have the opposite problem. For them, long time scales are easy and short time scales are hard. And getting to the millisecond time scale is a point where we can really meet and make direct connections to really test the things that we're predicting.
Let me ask you, I'm kind of dyslexic, so I want to get into the statistics of Folding at Home so that people can have an idea of the framework that's used to make these models. But somewhat of a background, you mentioned water is something you have to deal with. Maybe you could explain a little bit about how water is an issue and what's the benefit of modeling in silico versus crystallography with respect to water.
Yeah, so those are great questions. I think, you know, one thing actually that I was going to mention even earlier is that, you know, you could ask, why even bother doing this at the atomic scale? Is that really necessary? And in the case of, as I say, proteins involved in Alzheimer's, but this is true across the board in biology, is that there can easily be single amino acids that you change that can have a huge influence in people that have the disease. And so you're changing maybe just 5 or 10 atoms. And that's enough to sort of make the difference between someone getting Alzheimer's at an earlier age or someone not getting it at all. And so the atomic level is really important because we know these small changes in proteins can have this dramatic change in someone's life and the outcome.
I'll certainly vouch for that. You know, when developing drugs, I mean, right now, if you can get a mechanism of action down to the atomic level, you're securing yourself a durability factor of getting that drug to clinic rather than just did the rat die or did it survive, right?
Right.
You had an analogy of a rat in a bridge.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I could repeat that. It's, you know, the one thing that is our dream is that right now, drug design is largely empirical because I don't think we have the power to do it in a rational way. That, you know, we design bridges in rational ways, not empirical ways. That we don't, if you were to design bridges the way we design drugs, it would be like we have some vague idea for how to build a bridge, but we're not sure if it's really going to work. We're not sure if it's safe for people. So before putting people on the bridge, we have rats go over the bridge to see if it's safe. You know, and if that survives, then we put some you know, dogs or monkeys or whatever. And if that's safe, then we put people who really, really want to go across the bridge first. you know, but, you know, and that's not because people who design drugs are naive. It's quite the opposite. They're, I think, extremely talented using sophisticated methods. It's just that the problem is very, very hard. that biology is complicated, and you have to be really accurate to get this to work, to do it in a really rational way. And so there's been a dream for decades to use computation in drug design. And I think in the 80s, there was so much hype and it was so exciting that I think people bought in, but the computers really weren't ready for it. And I think every decade there's been renewed hope that the computers are finally ready for it. And you know, I think it would be dangerous and full of hubris to sort of guarantee that the computers are ready for it now. But I think what the difference is now in terms of perspective is that I don't think the goal is to sort of completely ditch the current methods for just using computers. The question is, how can computers gradually come in and help as an additional method to try to make things easier? And as time goes on, computers will play a larger and larger role. And eventually, and this may take 50 years or 100 years, maybe eventually the amount of experiment would be drastically less. But you know, people spend tens of billions of dollars on drug design. If computers could make that 10% more efficient, you know, 10% of $100 billion is a huge impact in terms of what we could do. And that's sort of, I think, a relatively modest goal. And the hope is obviously to be able to do more than that as time goes on.
Do you see this as a method to stimulate scientific inquiry in generating a model that you can then test? Or is the success rate been such that it can now be almost considered fact when you have a folding result or a chemical mechanism result?
Yeah. You know, I think it's interesting looking at sort of the spectrum of computational methods. There are some methods, especially methods where you're doing quantum mechanical calculations that 20 years ago were vigorously developed, and I think they were still pretty young then. Computers were not very powerful. And what happened 20 years ago is that when there was a computational result, it disagreed with experiment, it drew interest, but no one would necessarily trust the computational result over the experiment. I think the difference now in that field is that with a high enough level quantum mechanical result, if it disagreed with experiment, I think people would look at the experiment very carefully, especially if it was a very careful high level quantum mechanical calculation. We're not there right now in terms of the types of calculations we're doing, but we're at the point where I think if we have something that certainly generate hypotheses, that's interesting to test later experimentally, but I think we're starting to be able to predict things quantitatively in a way that I wouldn't trust 100% of the numbers, but that the fraction that are wrong is sufficiently small that I think there's a lot of interesting results coming from it. And we could talk about that in the context of our Alzheimer's work, where we've made very specific predictions and recently been able to publish results from that. And it has turned out really quite well in an area where the experiments are so challenging that I think computational methods are a really unique way to be able to push forward.
Let's get to that. We'll definitely get to the Alzheimer's results. I did interrupt your water.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I didn't finish that. Yeah. So, you know, the one thing about water is that water is something that we all take for granted because it's so beautifully simple and so, you know, common throughout the planet. And we all know how important it is for life. And we also know how simple it is molecularly. You know, it's just an oxygen and two hydrogens. I think the surprise, I think, for people who don't study chemistry is that water is a surprisingly complicated liquid, more complicated than, almost anything. And there's all these like little surprises that we sort of are familiar with, maybe in the back of your minds, that are weird. Like when you sort of freeze water, it actually becomes less dense than liquid water. So ice floats on top of liquid water, and that's good. Let's say if you're a fish in a pond in the winter or something like that, you want to freeze on the top and so on. But those properties are really odd. And other liquids don't behave that way. And it has to do technically with hydrogen bonding in the water, which makes it very complicated to deal with. And so anyways, the short answer is that water is just a really complicated system that I think biology really lives and thrives in that complexity, but it makes our life really, really challenging.
Because you don't simply add one H2O to your model, right? You've got water everywhere.
Yeah.
So
And water does also these really beautiful things where, in some cases where you have two proteins coming together, you might have water molecules that will basically resurface one surface such that protein A can bind with protein B without water. But if you put certain water molecules on it, A can bind with C. something that looks relatively different. And so it can play so many different roles that it just becomes a big challenge. And there's many celebrated scientists who spent their careers basically just trying to understand water. And so we're hopefully building on top of that and applying it in terms of this context for proteins, which spend their life usually in water.
In terms of structural biology and understanding atomic level life, the past 25 years, or God, the past 50 years has been based on crystals, where the biological molecule was taken out of solution and caused to form into an array of identically positioned units. Without water, right? Has your computational approach, which includes water, resulted in improved, or in any experiments, even if it's only happened 1 out of 10 times, has it resulted in a data that you've been able to now understand how something actually worked because you're including water?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, crystal structures often do have some water. They might be like 20% water or something like that, or maybe sometimes a little more. The challenge, though, is that often the water is unstructured, so you wouldn't see it in the refinement of the crystal. Or occasionally you will get a structured water there. You know, I think the comparison between a crystal structure and an NMR structure often shows that there maybe isn't dramatic differences in water. But I think one of the big debates that's interesting to consider is how rigid are proteins during their function and in solution. And I think there's a lot of growing interest in not just the structured aspects of proteins, but the unstructured ones. And especially during motion, things during function, proteins could become less structured in different ways. And where I think the next decade or two of structure biology is moving to is ironically towards unstructured aspects of proteins. That crystal structures have been sort of critically vital for knowing where to begin, but they are maybe more of a beginning than an ending for understanding function. And I think that's a really exciting thing. And I see that, for example, in our structural biology department here at Stanford, that there's a lot of interest in dynamics and heterogeneity and unstructured aspects. And I think water plays a role in all of that. But I think that's where, ironically, structural biology departments are moving to, understanding that structure is the beginning, but that really it's the biology part and the function part that's the exciting part.
I guess molecular machines, as proteins and enzymes are, and protein complexes that form larger molecular machines, if they're metastable, they're actually doing, they've got a higher level of importance, probably.
Also, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, it's really challenging to crystallize proteins in many cases. And I think, you know from firsthand.
Secondhand, I've got it.
So, you know, you have to ask, why would it be so hard to crystallize certain proteins? You know, one reason would be is that they are fairly heterogeneous and that it's difficult to get them to pack in a crystalline form. And so I think a lot of biology is of that character. You know, and so it's going to be this interesting challenge to see which parts are structured and which parts aren't. Even just also aspects of crystallography done under cryo conditions emphasize the crystalline nature and that there may be some more fluctuations than people expect.
Well, with crystallography, you have to sacrifice the tube to the crystal gods and wear your lucky shirt.
Yeah.
And if you're from Canada, you don't shave. You know, you just pray. But you know, it is so powerful to be able to see your molecules. You know, just think of the classic Watson and Crick structure, how it changed the world.
Right? Absolutely.
In our understanding of who we are. And by the way, I preface this with the fact that I started a company to study the physiology of water, and we're working at the physiological level in cells, and it's all about water, brain swelling, diuretics. There's a whole new field with an appreciation for water as a sort of disease state. It can be, certainly, and kills millions of people. But, the context is different from your work in that you're trying to figure out how all of life interacts with water, I suppose. You know, it's not, you're not a reductionist. You're the opposite of a reductionist. What would that be?
Yeah, or I think I'm especially interested where we all know how water behaves in bulk, which means if you have this infinitely big swimming pool, how the water in the middle behaves. I think there's been a lot of understanding. I think the interesting frontier is how is water changed when it's up against the surface of a protein or the ribosome or other biochemical machinery. And that I think how water is different in these confined areas is going to be especially interesting.
Let's move to folding at home as it's running today versus how it was running 2 years ago. Are you seeing an increase in users? Or, I mean, Moore's Law hasn't really produced CPUs that are or GPUs that are more dramatically faster.
Yeah.
How's that affected you guys?
Yeah, so in the last couple of years, so I think it's interesting that we've chatted every 2 years because I think in 2007, the PlayStation client for folding at home was just integrated. And it was an exciting time for us because we were able to leap to a petaflop very quickly. And that was very exciting. It got a Guinness World Record. It was actually just sitting right over there. We can put it on camera if people are curious. But and 2009, a few years later, we were able to take that technology and apply it to graphics processing units and push that even further. And what we've been working on since the last time we talked is to not necessarily push to new types of hardware, because actually in that time period, there really hasn't been new type of hardware that's been announced. There's been hope of things like Intel's Knight's Ferry and other things like that. But it really, I think it's been the hardware changes have been more incremental over the last 2 years than compared to, let's say, the difference between 2005 and 2007 or 2007 and 2009. And my thought, though, is very much these days to try to not push for new types of exotic hardware since there isn't anything to push for, but to really try to think about what we can do to expand our base and just make it easier to run folding at home. And so the changes that are about to be rolled out are changes not so much in pushing for brave new world, new technologies, but really to step back and say, what can we do to make it easy for someone who actually doesn't have a huge familiarity with computers to make it easy to run folding at home? One of the things that I'm excited about is that there's right now about 500,000 people running folding at home using just CPUs. If we could get, you know, just 1/5 of those people to run folding at home on their GPU, that would be 100,000 GPUs, which would be roughly about 100 petaflops of performance.
You know, so it'd be amazing.
Yeah, it'd be really amazing, and it would set the stage for us to get pretty close to 1,000 petaflops, also known as an exaflop, which is really a major, major grand challenge that most people are planning for supercomputers to reach only maybe 10, 15, 20 years from now. And so I think us reaching 100 petaflops is not crazy. It's something that all the ingredients are there from a conceptual point of view. This is more an issue of execution for us to be able to make it really easy for people to run on GPUs. And so the version 7 of our folding home software, which is still now under beta testing, I think we'll have some properties that will make that really easy. And so if we can push to 100,000 GPUs and maybe, you know, ideally a million CPUs, I think we'll get to the point where we'll be at 100 petaflops. And I think that will be a dramatic increase in the types of things that we could do.
With people's computer usage primarily being browsing on the net, is it possible to have in Google Chrome a button where you click on the button and now you're donating some of your CPU time while you're doing a low intensity, light demanding application just like browsing, and give away some of those CPU cycles with the benefit of maybe having ad free, or I would get that adds a cost level to it, right?
Yeah, I think we're exploring lots of different ways to try to make it as easy as possible as to install folding at home, some of the things are mentioned in the version 7 of the client, but we're already sort of thinking for the next step. And some of that is probably too early for me to talk about here. But I think your thinking is very much sort of on the ball in terms of what could we do to try to make it really, really easy. The one thing, though, is that when your computer's running a calculation, it's going to be using more electricity than when it's not running a calculation.
Sure.
And so there is something that, and we try to be really upfront about that, that it is a donation of computer time that you're giving, and it's a significant thing. I think what hopefully sets apart donations from Folding at Home to, say, other charities. And Folding at Home is very much a charity. It's a 501c through Stanford University. I think the difference is that you're really a direct participant of what's going on. You see the calculations being run. You see your part in it, which is different than other charities where you write a check and you sort of hope that the check is going to do good stuff.
You're a user. You're part of you're cog in the wheel of great research.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully, you know, you really are a contributor, a participant. And if you don't like what we're doing, the difference is too is that not only have you not just write a check, but you're deciding to contribute to us every day. And if we're not sort of doing a good job, you could choose not to contribute to us. And that happens all the time. And that type of thing is always on our minds to try to do the best we can to try to have the best experience for people running the software. And the part that's always a challenge for me is how to manage that and balance that with how to do the best science. And people, when they run Folding at Home, they see what's in front of them. And so that's an important part of this. But they don't really see the science. They don't come to the lab and see what we're doing day to day. And so that's something where they just sort of see maybe some of the results in terms of papers and press and things like that. But it's a tricky balance for me to make sure that we put enough into the software to make it easy to use and encourage people to use it. But then we put a lot into the science to make sure that it's not just a big computer game, but that it's something that is really dramatically accelerating the science for it.
Well, I'll certainly vouch for the science so that, you know, if the audience is wondering, are they wasting their CPU cycles on some dream or actually making contributions? These are pretty solid experiments and peer-reviewed in the grant reviews. You know, this is part of a very formidable scientific endeavor.
And I've been excited that our work also, you know, has gotten numerous awards for myself and my other colleagues. So I think we've 10 years ago, I wondered what the response would be because this is a very unusual way to do things. And I think if just running a big calculation isn't the exciting thing from my peers that do the science, in some ways, I think if you could run a smaller calculation and get the same answer, that'd be better. And I think a lot of what we're arguing is that that's just not possible, but we have to show that's really the case. But the fact that we've had such great feedback from the scientific community in terms of these standard mechanisms of papers and awards and so on is something also I think that we can bring to the Folding at Home donor community to show that that there is something that's really exciting going on.
Is it considered? Are people saying, yes, I like to run it, but it's costing me electricity? Are people really, I have to admit, I don't pay the electrical bills. My wife takes care of that. So I don't see, you know, I'm not the one going around the house turning off the lights. I prefer not tripping. Yeah. But
it's like having a 100-watt or more 200-watt light bulb running all the time. So it's not something in the sense that would break the bank or something like that, but it's a non-trivial amount of money. It's not like 5 cents either. And so I think this especially gets complicated when people run not one computer, but many computers. And there's some really exciting, phenomenal people out there that run racks of machines. And I've seen pictures of these things, and they're really beautifully laid out. And this is something that is really a major contribution of theirs. And electricity for that becomes fairly significant if we're talking about 20, 40, 100 processors, something like that. Then we're really talking about a lot of money. And I think it is something, especially at that scale, that one has to keep in mind.
How about a cap and trade style strategy where a company like Progressive Progressive, everybody goes home at night, but there's all those desktops. There's probably, 20,000 plus employees each with a desktop where they could offset some of the costs of their infrastructure if they were able to, pay a little less in taxes and offer the CPU time.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've always tried to do, and this is where I'm not a tax attorney or a lawyer, so I'm not completely familiar with these details, but try to find some way to have tax deductions for running Folding at Home and things like that. It's complicated, and this is not my area of expertise. But we have worked with other companies in the past and have been interested in doing these types of things. The exciting thing about this approach is that while a million computers or half a million computers sounds like a lot, there's billions of computers in the world. So this is a relatively, really pretty small fraction of the computers doing calculations. And I think as time goes on, just even doubling this or multiplying by 10 would have a dramatic increase in terms of what we can do scientifically, but would not be particularly onerous in terms of the impact of, you know, computers running in the world.
So you can never have too much.
Yeah, I mean, I think right now the problems are so challenging. It's like, you know, you never can know too much type of thing. You know, I think, you know, I'm also, I've always been, even as a kid, I've been just blown away with just the amazing things that go on in science. And that's why I love my job. I mean, I come to work every day and there's new results from people in my lab, new experimental results, new computational results. And, you know, that's the thing that wakes me up at, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning to come into work every day excited. So I think more computer power means that we can do either more complicated things or do things faster. And with diseases of the type that we're trying to go after, faster is definitely not a bad thing.
There's a comment by Space Guy who's saying folding at home sounds like finishing up your laundry because you're folding at home.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so before we go on to some of the disease challenges that you're working on, So how many people are actually, how many CPUs are there, how many GPUs, how many people are signed up right now?
Yeah, so, you know, over the course of the whole project, it's been millions and millions of people. I think in terms of computer, because it started in October of 2000, in terms of computers running right now, it's, I think, a bit under 500,000 computers. In terms of GPUs and PS3s, we're talking about 50 to 70,000 in that range. It's one thing is that there's seasonal fluctuations, and in the summer is usually when we have a dearth of machines. I think in part because it gets hot, you put more money into electricity, and you don't have this computer making it even hotter in the room and things like that. And also, I think a lot of college students run folding at home, and they go home and turn off their computers from college and things like that. Then in the winter, we see a big uptick. So I think this uptick can be almost like a factor of 30%, sometimes as much as a factor of 2. And so So that's where we are at this particular moment. As I mentioned, I'm excited about trying to get the point where we can really grow it by a factor of 10, and that will be interesting to see over the next year or so as we roll out these new technologies, how that goes.
There's 100. It looks like on your stats window, it says almost 4 million, 3.9 million Windows computers, 147,000 OS X machines from PowerPC. Wow.
Yeah.
Still running PowerPC.
So I think those numbers, I think, are cumulative. And so that's, okay. And you know, people come and go or get new computers or reinstall the software. And I think there's numbers for actives that that are lower, but still, you know, on the order of 500,000 type of that.
And when it says native teraflops and versus x86 teraflops,
yeah,
are those, what's the difference?
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting things is that a GPU can execute certain instructions like a sine or a cosine or exponential. And in the GPU, it takes one cycle to do that, one flop. It counts as one flop in the GPU. But on an x86 machine, it's typically counted as like 30 flops or 50 flops. And so we try to be really very straightforward about flop accounting, especially since our numbers
flop are... Flop accounting.
Yeah, well, and, you know, our numbers are so, you know... were so huge when we got to petaflops that I wanted to be very conservative and very transparent in terms of where these numbers were coming from, in part because people just couldn't believe them. So that's why we explain it in both ways. I think x86 flops is a good way to think about it in terms of just comparing to as a baseline. But if you do flop accounting in certain ways, the GPUs look like they're actually doing less flops just because they're more efficient. But in fact, they're really doing amazing things.
So where's the hardware that is, so this is distributed computing. In terms of clusters, how fast is the fastest cluster versus the distributed computing? Right now, it looks like in the summer, you've got a summer number of 6.4 petaflops. But What's it like for hardware that like IBM's Blue Gene, or what's the fastest? Who's your competitor in terms of clustering?
Yeah. So I think we have been the fastest computer in terms of just raw petaflops for quite a while, though there's recently now a machine that just came in at 10 petaflops. But the one thing about flop accounting is that also that this is a bit apples and oranges in a couple different ways. One way that is not fair to the supercomputers is that they run an application that we can't run here because it uses very tightly coupled machines. And so then what might say is that, well, this number isn't really comparable to theirs, or that ours isn't comparable to theirs. But what we, if we ran our calculations on their machine, and we can do that very easily, their machine would be getting much, I think, less flops than we're doing, because it's really hard to do molecular dynamics calculations compared to the more linear algebra calculations that they use to sort of advertise the flops. You know, so...
They're using basic math, and you're going with the high order calculations.
Yeah, we're going with pretty complicated things versus linear algebra. And so, you know, I think the interesting thing, and we have now a new piece of software that lets us run calculations in the Folding at Home style on supercomputers. And this is a collaboration with Eric Lindahl's group in Stockholm and Peter Kasson's lab in University of Virginia. But this new piece of software called Copernicus is basically Folding at Home meets supercomputers. And it one, we could use it as a benchmark to do apples to apples, although that really wasn't our intention. But our hope is to really bring all the advances that have come in on the Folding at Home side to traditional supercomputers as well. And if we did that, I think you'd see that I think Folding at Home probably for that calculation is still doing better. But... you know, I think the real question is not sort of this sort of whose number is bigger kind of thing. It's kind of what results are you getting? And because in the end of the day, I think that's what the people running Folding at Home want to see. And that's right. what I would see.
That's why you're so the – how do I put this? Your plate is full. Right, you're not only developing the technology, but you're also applying it in a way where I've seen you give a talk. It was a few years ago at Yale, and you're sitting there arguing about water with Stites and the statistics, and you know, dealing with you know, the scientific world on top of your head, on your shoulders, making sure that you're doing this in a very conservative in a way that's conservative, but moving forward. So you've got some science that you have to worry about, and then some of the engineering, computational engineering that you've got to deal with. And then, you know, getting the word out and growing the franchise of Folding at Home as well, if I can call it franchise, because you've got to get the brand out and get people using it to actually drive the, it's your engine for your car. Is there any efforts to clone what you're doing at Folding at Home to other computational ventures? Are companies that are doing, for example, modeling, you know, marketing behavior, consumer behavior, or weather, or military? Are they borrowing your distributed computing approach and buying a million PS3s and putting them together? Is it growing? Are people cloning you, basically?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different ways. I think most of the more obvious connections are in areas closer to our local area of expertise. So in the molecular simulation area, there's a lot of technology that was built for Folding at Home that's now being used in other areas, especially an area called Markov state models, which is a sort of statistical analysis technique that is naturally applied to Folding at Home style calculations, but can be done more broadly than that. I think one of the things that I think is also exciting that is now becoming more commonplace is this concept of cloud computing. And cloud computing has a lot in common with the distributed computing that we've been doing over the last 10 years, that there's this big rack of machines that aren't coupled in the way of a traditional supercomputer coupled and might be, in general, somewhat heterogeneous and distributed throughout the world. And you have to decide, how do you divide your calculation to go up between all these different machines? And that's the intellectual challenge, is that if we had one machine that was a million times faster, that would be very easy to use, and we wouldn't have to redo our thinking for anything. But instead, we have, let's say, a million machines that are regular speed. And that's really the challenge, how to break up a calculation that's normally just you think about as being on one machine into a million parts and have it done in an efficient way. And I think the spirit of being able to do that in a domain which I think on the surface we thought would be not be possible, I think that has affected other areas, and people are thinking about other statistically minded ways to break up calculations. And so in that sense, I think there has been applications as well. And I frequently sort of get emails from people and from academics and other disciplines that are just curious to sort of get started and think about you know, how these approaches could be used in their case.
One person in the chat room asked about an Android app, but how would this work on a battery-powered device?
You know, this has been on my mind, and I think we have a plan. I think we just need to wait until some things come online. So there's two problems with being on a phone or an Android tablet or something like that. Problem number one is that we need really pretty fast floating point calculations. And so this is a big deal. If we'd only had a typical ARM processor, we wouldn't have floating point hardware, and the calculation would run so slow it wouldn't be worth it. Problem number two is that if you have enough floating point hardware, you're going to run really fast, but then you're going to burn up your battery really fast. Not burn up in the sense of it's going to explode. It just, you know, you'll just drain the battery really fast. And I think the solution to the first problem is that I think it's going to be the GPUs on the phone that will be interesting. And if you look at the hardware in a phone, the phone is a very heterogeneous computing device. It typically has a CPU, but has lots of other devices on it as well. Maybe a CPU, maybe some hardware to do video in hardware, so you can get that without draining the CPU and do it in a very battery-efficient fashion. And then a GPU to do graphics in a battery-efficient fashion. And I don't think we will want to go after the CPU, but going after the GPU could be very exciting, especially since we have code for GPUs. And I think the new class of phones that are coming out maybe in the next generation might support OpenCL. There's rumors that the next iPhone could support OpenCL on its GPU. And with an OpenCL, we'd actually be able to run, you know, maybe not super fast on the phones, but we'd be able to get something out of them that would be useful. And maybe that multiplied by 10 million phones gets to be interesting.
I guess when they're docked, right?
Yeah, and then you've guessed the answer to the second problem is that I think we're not going to be doing it while you're running around away from home. I think it would be something where you dock it at night to get to power it up, and that's what I do with my phone every night. I hook it to a dock so it gets powered. And at home, it will get powered, and it will be on Wi-Fi, although we don't send that much data back and forth, but at least this way, you won't worry about even data transfers or anything like that. And 8 hours on 10 million devices is, you know, that's a pretty big amount of computing. So that's something that has caught our attention, and that's what I've been sort of waiting for before we dive into that. But I think that's not that far off.
Now, you have a very good relationship with Sony in that PlayStation 3 has played a large part of your cloud. How about the Sony Bravia TV line or one of their TV lines? Aren't they running Linux right now?
It's a good question. I actually haven't thought about that. I don't know that much about the processors on the TVs. So that's an interesting question. That's something I actually had never thought about. One of the comments or questions or concerns that comes up all the time is that whether we're in a post-PC world and that desktops, you know, will no longer be all that common. And I think sometimes people take that to an extreme, like tomorrow the desktops will just disappear, you know, they'll go poof or something like that. So I think the devices that will be most commonplace will be mobile and laptops, but I think people are still selling hundreds of millions of, you know, PCs every day. And there's people that are avid gamers or design artists or someone that have very powerful GPUs. And so I think it's going to be maybe the laptops and mobile that get the buzz, but desktops are going to be a fundamental part of computing, I think, for the foreseeable future. And so we'll be able to run on that. We can run on laptops, and they have great GPUs nowadays compared to what they were a few years ago. So I think the future of that is interesting. But what I think got us excited about the PS3 was that as these technologies go into more consumer devices, either with a cell processor or a GPU, there would be really interesting possibilities. So it might be a little early for TVs, although it's something for me to look into details. But it's not crazy to imagine that, you know, a GTX 580 class GPU could be in, you know, TVs in 2 years, and that could be a huge amount of computing power.
So I guess, you know, the post-PC era concern, if you look at what hit the news, was it today or yesterday, with HP dropping their consumer computer desktop line? Maybe it'll turn into Compaq again. They'll just release it. But then again, you know, these look MacBook Airs. I've got one of the Thunderbolt MacBook Airs, and it blazes.
Absolutely.
But it also blazes so fast it has no battery life. Yeah. But that means I plug it in all the time.
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. So now I've got this blazing mobile unit, which is if it's going to be plugged in anyway, and it has a very, very high efficiency CPU in terms of power consumption. I mean, isn't that the best of your biggest concern or client's biggest concern is the use of, paying for 100 watt light bulb. What if that 100 watt light bulb's now running on 3 watts and still producing the same cycles? I think we're starting to really solve some of the entry humps that you have to get over, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's very exciting. And also, you know, I mean, there will eventually be a next generation Xbox and PlayStation, most likely. And, you know, even the most conservative thing that Sony could do, and I have no knowledge of what the PS4 is going to be like, but the most conservative thing that they could do is just take the cell processor, expand it a little bit, and add a new NVIDIA or ATI graphics chip. And that alone, if that's bundled for $300, is an amazing machine to run folding at home. And so I think the game console area alone could be a very exciting part for folding home. And if it were only game consoles, I think we'd still be able to reach a lot of interesting targets.
Are you using at all the game? God, I drew a blank. I have kids that are, Xbox. I've got little kids, so everything's Nintendo. And, you know, and Leo, by the way, if he's listening, he's always, said, the Nintendo's is somewhat of a toy. Well, actually, my kids have been using it for a couple of years, and it is a toy, and it's probably the most important toy in the house. They've played the Star Wars, Lego Star Wars, from cover to cover, and it's really fun to watch, at the time, a 5 and 7-year-old help each other out through some of the most difficult gaming challenges. It's just a lot of fun. But even Nintendo, the Wii 3, right? Or what do they call it? The new Wii that's coming out?
I forget the name of it, but it's going to be much more higher powerful, more powerful, and also higher res.
Yeah, HD. So it's going to have a better graphics card. So are you working in Xbox and Nintendo?
We're currently not, although it's something we keep an eye on. I think, again, the processor in the Xbox is not as powerful as a cell processor, and the GPU also wasn't all that useful for us to go after. But I think this next generation of game machines could be particularly exciting, depending on what goes into them. So that's kind of where my mind is right now, and I'd love to be able to have something ready for launch. Obviously, this has a lot to do with our partners and whether, whenever that launch is going to be, and I don't have any knowledge of that. But that's something that has been on my mind quite a bit, because I think this could be the future of an important part for folding at home.
Well, I think on the game console area, the Kinect is sort of leading as the driving force as to what people adopt. And I see my kids, begging for the next level of gaming unit, or, everybody else, all the kids are getting Xboxes right now on top of their Nintendos. So who knows? But then again, Red Ring of Death and, I love Microsoft so much, running Windows right now on Skype, which is Microsoft as well. So we, live them. You got to look. So let's get to the science. Now, we now have an understanding or a background on the folding home statistics and the power of the unit and some of the fundamental paradigms in terms of criteria that you need to address in terms of like handling water and handling questions of biological questions in a time frame that's actually relevant with respect to modeling life. Could you tell us a little bit about your Alzheimer's work that was recently published, or some of the stuff that's in the lab going on right now? And it'd be a great example of how you're using people's CPU time and GPU time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So So it maybe it's useful for me to step back and talk a little bit about how what's going on in Alzheimer's in the first place. And so what's really challenging about Alzheimer's is that it's a very different type of disease. It's not something where there's some invading pathogen or something like that. It's actually a part of our body, a particular protein that instead of assembling or folding into the right form, it starts to misfold. And then starts to these misfolded states are very sticky and start to clump up and form these misfolded aggregates. And these aggregates eventually get to some point where they're toxic and kill brain cells, kill neurons, which leads to the sort of phenotype that we're used to seeing in Alzheimer's patients, the forgetting of memory and all the nasty things that comes along with that. And so what's challenging about this from the point of view of structural biology is that we're studying something that doesn't have a well-defined structure. It's not something that can be put into X-ray crystallography. It's very challenging to do with other structural techniques like NMR. You know, usually if you have a protein that's misbehaving like this, you throw it away and you go work on something else. It's not something that you really want to go after. But we can't.
I've tried,
that.
By the way.
Yeah,
I've tried doing NMR on fibers, but transthyretin fibers. It was rough.
Yeah,
Pattern diffraction.
In this case, we don't have that luxury, right? This is the thing we have to go after. So, what I've always thought is that in cases where experiments are particularly challenging, that's maybe the opportunity for simulations to come in and maybe contribute something because the experimental world is so tough for this particular problem. And so what we did a couple years ago is that we've been using folding at home to go after the problem of misfolding in Alzheimer's disease of these particular proteins called A-beta peptides. And what we've been able to do is to simulate the process and come up with a structure of sorts. It's very heterogeneous. It's not very well defined the way you would have a crystal structure. But it gave us a lot of hints for structural elements that might be relevant. And so the first experimental paper testing those hints came out just a few weeks ago. And it basically demonstrated that the predictions from the simulations appeared to be valid. And I think there's a couple different things I think that we could learn from this. One is that I think we're starting to understand aspects of some very subtle parts of Alzheimer's. That this protein that misfolds either could be 42 amino acids long or 40. It's also possible with 41 and 43, but 40 and 42 are most commonly looked at. And the strange thing is that 42 is really nasty and toxic when it's 42 amino acids long. But you just chop off two amino acids at the end, suddenly it's not so bad. And that's really strange how two amino acids could make that much difference. It speaks to this, you know, role of atomic detail being really important. But I think that was a really big mystery. And also, I think what often happens experimentally is that 42 is so poorly behaved that you work on 40 and you learn a lot about 40. But if 40 is not really the toxic element or all that interesting, you've learned some things about Alzheimer's, but maybe not as much as you would like.
Where are the extra two, at the start or at the end, or in the middle?
At the end. And so one of the things that our simulations predicted is why there would be a difference. And this is a bit technical, but I think for people familiar with structural biology in the audience, we predicted a beta hairpin centered around residues 37 and 38. And what those two amino acids do is that it lengthens this beta hairpin. So instead of being just, let's say, two amino acids long, it's four or five. And that can make a huge difference in the cooperativity of this hairpin. The difference between two amino acids on each side and five is pretty dramatic. And I think, if nothing else, this to me feels like the character of what the answer would have to be like. But, you know, it doesn't have to be right. But we were able to test this experimentally and demonstrate that by stabilizing that hairpin, we can actually stabilize an oligomeric state, even to the point where one can do experiments on it. And so that was an exciting thing for validation of folding at home. But I think even just for the science of it, I think it opens a door towards this new information being used as a therapeutic. And there's unpublished results from my lab in that direction. I'll talk a little bit about that in broad strokes, but we're about to submit papers on that, so I don't want to go into too many details. But my hope is to be able to get a therapeutic out of these results from folding at home such that the folding at home results is not just living in the computer world where we make some predictions and somebody else tests it and they sort of run with it and do something exciting. I really want to be there to really push it all the way. and to really make the most out of the calculations we're doing and have a very tight interplay between the experiments that one can do and the calculations that we can do.
And I guess would you try to be modeling a drug to bind to the C-terminus bind to the end of the protein to extend it, stabilizing it to form a better hairpin? Or is it the opposite? Or am I getting it straight?
Yeah, I think shorter what we want to do is that we want to sort of bind to that hairpin to maybe prevent other A-beta peptides from binding to it.
All right. And forming so a chain of garbage.
Yeah, and that way break up aggregation.
Wow.
And so that...
I was going to ask you, so what we're looking at is A-beta is a folded peptide, but it unfolds, stretches out, and then... molecular interactions happen in the backbone that create a ladder-like structure? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things is that if you wait long enough, you form fibrils, which is what you mentioned for transthyretin as well. One of the interesting questions is whether, and this is hotly debated, and I don't think we'll get consensus right now in the community, is whether the fibrils are the toxic element or a small molecular weight oligomer, just like whether it requires a million of them to be toxic or just like 3 or 12 or 24 could be toxic. My personal reading of the literature and the experimental data is that the smaller things are the toxic ones, and maybe the bigger ones might even be non-toxic. Some of the, I think, most compelling evidence towards that is that if you have drugs that break up the fibrils, we get a very specific result. It seems that drugs that break up the fibrils are pretty nasty when done in clinical trials and seem to have pretty negative results. And I think a natural interpretation of that is that if the fibrils were non-toxic and the small stuff were toxic, you break up the fibrils, you make more small stuff, you get more toxic stuff, and things get worse.
So
we've been going after the small stuff to try to break it up at a really early stage. And I think what we've learned about the structure of these small stuff, I think gives us an idea for how that might be possible.
I guess preventing the formation of fibrils altogether is a good strategy to aim at, rather than worrying about the end product and breaking it down from that end, preventing the onset of the disease by preventing the amyloid fibers from doing anything at all.
Right.
I guess gene therapy approach would be to modify that end of the gene as well. Or can you knock out the amyloid beta?
This is where I'm not an expert, but I believe it has been knocked out in mice. And I think, I forget if it's a lethal knockout or not. There are a variety of hypotheses for what A-beta does as a part of APP, the larger A-beta precursor protein that's in the membrane. There's even, I think, some ideas for what A-beta might naturally do when it's cut out. And that maybe that you want to have some free A-beta, and that might even have a role. One of the things that that your audience might find interesting and something that we've been trying to push to is a way for us to have some impact in drug design from an academic setting. And this has always been a real frustration of mine and some of my colleagues, is that if we get to something that gets to be really interesting, there's a point where we're sort of stuck, that doing drug design in an academic setting has limitations. I don't have the resources that a pharmaceutical company can throw at something to have 20, 30 organic chemists plugging to do optimization of a given lead and so on. And also, they're really good at that, and that's not necessarily the strength of academics. I think we're better at basic science and getting maybe to a lead stage is as far as we should go. But that then becomes the problem. How does this sort of transition from sort of the world of, well, this is interesting, this is experimentally validated, it's moving along, but will it ever sort of see the light of day as a drug? Will it ever have an impact to do all the things that we've been sort of dreaming of? And I think an area that I think opens the door to do that in academia that is starting to become, I think, popular in general is an area of drug repurposing. And in this idea, what you do is that you take existing drugs that are used for some original purpose and find some new purpose for them. And, there's examples of this already. I don't know if I have allergies, so I take Benadryl. Benadryl will make you sleepy, and actually, in hindsight, it's not a surprise. It's actually the same drug in Unisom or certain types of Unisom tablets. Mm-hmm. And so, especially if you have allergies and you want to go to sleep, it's fantastic. It works in both ways. Another good example is Viagra. I think it was originally intended as a hypertension drug and now has other applications as a more dominant application. So repurposing has happened quite a bit. The challenge is, can you use computational methods to predict what drugs could be used for the purpose that you want to go after? And so we're also going after using this information from the folding home simulations to identify drugs, but identify small molecules, but also identify drugs that we could repurpose towards these goals. And that's the part that I'm particularly excited about, that's stuff that's not published, is the idea of hopefully finding some drug that we could repurpose. Because if we could, that drug's already gone through early stage clinical trials for its original indication. And it's something where it could very quickly in principle, go into clinical trials for new indications if it looks good in animal models and so on.
That sounds like a really good strategy as well to demonstrate the viability of the technologies that you're using. Or you know, sometimes you got to go after the low-hanging fruit first, or else you're going to, you know, a failure. What's a failure? It's hard to tell whether it worked or not. And if you can take a drug and repurpose it, and you can make predictions as to the success of that repurposing, it'd be fantastic.
Yeah,
I just bought a library of 200,000 compounds. It's coming next week, and we're gonna have a fridge full of little plates full of compounds. It'd be really nice just to predict which ones I really need to test, rather than go through 200,000 reactions.
Yeah, and actually, you know. You know, and it's not that you're lazy, it's that it's hard to do. And also, if you're going to go through 200,000, you're not going to spend a day per compound. You're not going to do this super careful assay. You have to do some more high throughput assay. There's no way around it. And one of the things that I've found is that in certain types of high throughput assays, there's ways that drugs can sort of cheat on the test. You know, if you have a fluorescence assay, sometimes the drug itself fluoresces.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, there's all these things that can go on that if you can do a more low throughput assay, you have more chances to sort of go through this. And I think you're hitting at exactly what I think is going to be the current role for computation in drug design, which is that it's not going to be that a computation is going to predict one compound that's going to be tested just to check it. It's going to work, and then we move on, and everything's done. What's going to happen is that computation is going to take a library of a million, 10 million, or even 200,000 compounds and say, well, we think this is the top 100, top 1,000 best choices. And instead of trying to assay 200,000, if you could just do a careful job at these 100 or these 1,000, we think that there's a much greater chance that something really exciting is there. And, you know, we do experimental assays in my lab as well. And I think it's been useful for the sociology of the lab to see that, you know, when you make a prediction, it's not that we throw it over the fence and someone else has to do all the sort of hard work with going through it. That you know, we're going to go through it ourselves, and we really want these predictions to be great. Otherwise, you know, we're going to be wasting time doing experiments. But you know, I think our yields in some cases are getting to be really quite high. You know, 10%, 20%, such that if you screen 200 compounds, you'll get multiple compounds that are looking actually interesting. And I think that's really where computational drug design is right now. And, you know, there's many people in this field, so it's not only our work that's, I think, achieving results like that. My hope, though, is that by using more accurate methods that maybe are more computationally demanding, we'd be able to push these numbers higher and higher.
Yeah, I've got there's a thin line between intellectual property discussions here. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about is maybe if you could go back and we're talking about you know, modeling Alzheimer's, maybe you could give us a detail, because we went through it pretty quickly, as to how you modeled the folding of the A beta amyloid precursor protein. And how it gave you the prediction as to that the beta hairpin loop, if I got the terminology right.
Yeah.
How did you do the experiment? How did you throw it into folding at home?
Yeah. So we did that the way we would study protein folding, but there's a few twists on it. So the way we study protein folding, let's say with just one chain, is that we start it from a variety of unfolded structures. And then we let simulations sort of start from there and see where they go. And then we all the results come back to Stanford, and we build initial models to see what's happened and to try to see where would be interesting places to run new simulations. And we can do this in a way that's very statistically significant and trying to be very optimal. That if it's imagined like you're trying to search a room in the dark – and you want to cover the whole room with a little time as possible, as most efficient resources as possible. Basically, you don't want to look where you've already looked. And if you find something new, like, oh, the room has a door, well, maybe, you know, you found this new room, you want to put more time there. There's actually statistical methods that we and others have developed that can really handle that very efficiently. And so we build models, we use those models to tell us what we know and especially what we don't know, what's on the frontiers of things that we need to learn. And that runs calculations in new places. And this can be extremely efficient in terms of sort of finding structures and finding new places compared to traditional MD simulation that just sits and kind of lets the molecule do what it wants. One analogy I often make is that you can imagine having some undergraduates in your lab. They might be really smart, doing great things, but if you don't talk to them for a year, you know, they're going to get stuck or get bored or do things they shouldn't be doing. And that's kind of like a traditional simulation that you just let it go and you don't touch it. But what we do is we take these undergrads, and we might have lots of them in the analogy. You know, we've got lots of computers. And instead of just letting them go and they'll get stuck and frustrated and so on, we pay attention to them and talk to them. We find out what they're doing, what has worked, what hasn't worked, and share information between them. And they use that information to try to sort of figure out what they don't know and what they need to go after. And that can be considerably more efficient than just sort of leaving them alone and hoping for the best. And actually, we can statistically demonstrate this in cases. So that's sort of at the high level. At the low level, what's going on is that we're simulating the A-beta peptide or multiple peptides in all atom detail for the peptide and for the water. And we can use molecular dynamics methods to just see how these proteins would move. And you can start it unstructured, but they'll eventually move into more structured formats. And we can see which structured formats dominate the calculation and which ones we think are the ones that will be most common in the experiment.
When you did this experiment, did you send it out to a subset of machines that are hooked up to Foley at Home, or did you send it to all of them? And how much redundancy was there?
Yeah, so at any given time, there's lots of different calculations going on. And so I don't think we've ever, other than the really early days when we had just 10,000 machines, I don't think we've ever had a calculation that used all the machines simultaneously. But since the machines sort of cycle in stochastically, probably each machine contributed something, or there's a high probability each machine contributes something to the calculation since it was run for quite a while. In terms of redundancy, we try to minimize redundancy in the sense of sending people the exact calculation because, some other distributed computing projects do redundancy for points and cheating, checking and things like that, but that cuts your computer power in half or third or quarter, which, you know, is a pretty drastic cut. We worked so hard for computer power, I didn't want to kill it with redundancy that way. But we have redundancy in a statistical sense that the calculations are different, but they are statistically sampling the same distribution. And this is important because if calculations don't complete, it doesn't destroy. In some cases, our calculation might just slow us down. And also, it gives us some redundancy to see if something is weird in a calculation, if something is an outlier of the distribution, we have some information about that. And so we do those types of things in a statistical way, not in a sort of more computer science, we're going to do the exact same thing in comparisons.
How long did it take to run the calculation?
Yeah, I think that the calculation ran for about a year probably. And that's not unusual. We have a lot of things that run for about a year.
My God.
Yeah, it's something where, and that sort of your life has to be sort of structured in a way that you're used to that, because some science, especially on calculations, runs for like a day. And people come to my lab and they're used to that sort of rhythm of things where something will run for a day and you'll get your answer back. But when something runs for a year, you have to make really sure that it's going to be correct. That you don't want to wait for that year and then find out, oh, I forgot to do this or I forgot to do that, and then wait another year. You know, that's a disaster.
No.
You know, that's a disaster. And so
it's
this
a graduate
is
student
sort of,
hell. I mean,
yeah,
if you want to graduate, you're like, oh my God, another year.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's why when it's running for that year, we're not like leaving it alone and hoping for the best. We're keeping an eye on it. We're doing calculations intermediate to make sure everything's going well. And, you know, we're babysitting it and making sure everything's going well. But what that leads us to do, though, is to do a lot of calculations in parallel, where if a calculation takes a year, we might start, you know, one calculation in January, another calculation in March, another calculation in September, and so on, such that every 3 months we have one calculation that's ending. And that way that there's always data to look at and always things to do, because otherwise also people would just be waiting around doing nothing, which would be, you know, a disaster as well. And so all our calculations are pipelined. And one of the interesting sociology about research in my lab is that it's become very common for us, one person to set up calculations that they will actually never see the results of, because they'll graduate by the time the results are done. But
oh, that's good.
New people coming in the lab get to analyze data that they never were involved in setting it up. But that's kind of nice. It's like free data. It's like someone else doing an experiment for you, and you get to do the fun part. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of pay it forward in the lab that and things are just going on sort of in this pipeline fashion. And there are a few people like me and some programmers that are here for the long haul, but that makes organizationally things challenging to make sure that there is this sustained memory of what's going on and that we make the most of things. But that's more a challenge for me than anything else.
You know, my cardiologist, he's an MD, PhD, and one thing he was saying about comparing the PhD to the MD was that every day you're in med school is one day less that you're not in med school.
Yeah.
Right. You move forward. And if you have a PhD and you're doing a calculation, it takes a year. I appreciate the fact that you're having a serial or approach to the science and allowing students to come in, make a contribution, and depending where they're coming in with that, at what time point they can still get out and have made a contribution. Yeah. And
I mean, one upside, though, by the way, is that since they can come in and have data already, there's been several people who've graduated my lab in 4 years, which is pretty short as far as PhDs go.
Absolutely.
And so if things go well, they can go really well, that you have really unique data that you can do interesting things and then move on.
Did you do yours in three?
Yeah, so I did mine in three. I think it was a nice combination of luck and working my ass off.
That's good. Yeah, that's cool. And you're at MIT and you're doing some really cool, neat stuff. So that's pretty cool. So I think we've covered, your current story, where you're at right now. And it seems like, you know, it's really an honor and a pleasure to talk to someone who's really pushing that frontier forward. And I can see it as being, a valuable tool that sort of has a ripple effect out into the field of biophysics and drug discovery and, even the basic sciences of, to piece together what we understand of the human body in terms of molecular machines. Because, again, as I can't stress the importance of understanding a mechanism of action of either a drug or how a metabolite works, we really need to see it at the atomic level if we're going to be able to apply it to major unmet medical needs. So it's a real honor and a pleasure to be speaking with you today. And I really appreciate you coming on to the TWiT Network and being on that screen right there. That's really cool.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I've always enjoyed our chats. So thank you for having me.
Cool. And and thanks for being the first one in the TWiT brick house. This is cool. I'd like to thank also Liz Romero, who did the boards today with Burke McQuinn. Thank you for taking care of the audio and video recordings. I'd also like to thank the team that make this possible. Leo Laporte, Lisa Kinsel, Frederic Louis, Aline Rivera, Tony Wang, Mike Taylor, John Slanina, Jeff Stewart, Jason Howell, and the rest of the team in Petaluma, California. I'd also like to thank Phil Pelsey, Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. If you have any comments or suggestions, I can be reached at mark@twit.tv or on Twitter at Mark Pelletier. I guess that's it. This is a heavy show. You may want to listen to it twice. I certainly will. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Pelletier.